Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis.
John Lennon was a musical genius and one of the most beloved cultural figures of the 20th century. His songs inspired dreamers to imagine. His search for the truth gave power to the people. But some thought he dreamed too much. Others thought he was too powerful. So he was followed. He was threatened. He was declared a danger to the United States. And in 1980, he was assassinated. This is his story, told by his so-called friends.
This is Special Agent Jim Steele with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, working case number 009-08-0491. Case subject is Lennon John Winston Ono. This information pertains to a period ending June 1974. Interview subject is Nilsen Harry Edward III, interview number 1-05-761-974. Recall number 1, December 23rd, 1980.
Was I a bad influence on John Lennon, or was he a bad influence on me? Take your pick. I didn't force any foul-tasting liquids down his throat. In my eyes, I was the one hanging out with them, the Beatles. And you can commit murder with that crew. I thought, well, if they drink, I'll drink. And at the same time, they're thinking, well, Harry's this big drinker, so we'll live like Harry. We'd laugh like hell all night long and not know what we were laughing about. Ringo would call me the next day and ask, can you remember one thing that we laughed about last night? It became a problem in all our lives. I think when you get to self-pity and suicidal thoughts, you know, I'm no good, nobody likes me, boo-hoo. You have no friends except for the ones who are drinking with you. And you simply cannot see things for the way they truly are. I think that's when you quit. That's when you stop. Look back, take stock, and realize that you've left all this blood on the tracks.
I'll admit it. I wasn't the best influence on John Lennon.
Was I a bad influence on John Lennon?
I'm not about to take responsibility for all the crazy shit he did in 1974, but, you know, I didn't exactly help the situation.
Well, Harry's his big drinker.
When you've spent the night drinking your weight in Brandy Alexander's, there's really nothing you can do to help any situation. Not a thing. Me? I didn't know it at the time, but I was on the cusp of going from good to bad to worse. That's a well-documented fact. I had some solid successes with Everybody's Talking, Coconut, Without You. Nilsen Schmilsen was nominated for some Grammys, even won. But I didn't make it easy to keep the hits coming. Look, man, I didn't tour or perform live, and I wasn't exactly David Cassidy, peering out at you on my album covers with a cute smile and feathered hair. In fact, I looked frumpy as hell in my fucking bathrobe on the one that we called Nilsen Schmilsen, which is also a great big fuck you to the very notion of album titles. While on the subject of fuck you, when I won a Grammy for Without You, I immediately followed that record up with a song that said fuck you in the chorus.
And you simply cannot see things for the way they truly are.
And then I followed that with a little touch of Schmilsen in the Night, an album entirely of standards from the Great American Songbook. I wasn't exactly gunning for sales or radio play. More like fueling up for self-destruction. Life, am I right? Give it a few years and things will fuck right up just nicely on their own. It was just 1968 and the Beatles gave that press conference in New York when they formed Apple Records. Some reporter asked them who their favorite American singer was, and John and Paul both answered Nilsson. My phone rang off the hook for days. You couldn't ask for better press. It was better than airplay, better than a decent record review. And then, before I knew it, I was everywhere. Not as a famous celebrity, understand. Many people knew me simply as Nilsson. Since I didn't do the promotional circuit, there was a bit of mystery as to who or what I really was. But I mean, I was everywhere. I was in the studio when the Beatles cut Piggies. I recommended this new songwriter, Randy Newman, and even performed an entire album of his songs. I watched Carly Simon as she tracked her vocal for You're So Vain while Mick Jagger sang backup. I'm not overstating it when I say that the Beatles made my career. But I didn't need a little help from my friends to unmake it. I could do that on my own just fine. My point is, life, man. You go from receiving public accolades from the Beatles, of all people, to what some would reasonably call a low point, just a few years later when you're hungover, eyes bloodshot, offering angel dust to the same people who once sang your praises.
It became a problem in all our lives.
No shit. I asked Paul McCartney if he wanted to smoke some angel dust. Or maybe it was a horse tranquilizer.
Take your pick.
I was at the beach house in Santa Monica, the one that John rented and we were all crashing at while we were making Pussycats. John was passed out in bed with May, and then Paul and Linda just showed up. In 1974, who was the last person you would expect to show up at a house that John Lennon is renting? Paul McCartney, right? Fucking A, man. Because at this point, the word on the street is that John and Paul hate each other's guts. They're suing each other. They're taking cheap shots at each other on their solo albums. But after Yoko had sent John to Los Angeles on this soul-searching walkabout or whatever the hell it was, when Yoko finally decided she was ready to welcome John back into her life and to try to repair their marriage and, you know, start over, Yoko was the one who went directly to Paul and asked Paul to play the role of intermediary peacekeeper. So Paul flies out to L.A. and hunts John down at the Santa Monica beach house. John's sleeping. It's late morning or early afternoon, and I'm drinking and smoking whatever I can get my hands on because my mouth tastes like a dumpster. My head's on fire from whatever we did the night before. And there's all kinds of stuff floating around, grass, coke, PCP. I ask Paul if he wants some angel dust while he's waiting for John to wake up.
I didn't force any foul-tasting liquids down his throat.
He goes, "What is it?" And I say, "I don't know, man. Maybe it's a horse tranquilizer. I mean, honestly, someone told me it was angel dust, but what the hell do I know?" And so Paul asks, "Is it fun?" I thought long and hard about that. It was a fair question. I think at that point I knew what we were doing was not sustainable, that it was destructive, that it was wrong.
It became a problem in all our lives.
But of course, every day we just started right up again, drinking and drugging to drown out those sorts of thoughts. But this was still early enough in the day, and I could respond with some truth. "Nah," I tell Paul, "it's really not fun at all." Paul passed on the angel dust. Once John woke up, he was surprised to see Paul waiting for him. I honestly don't know how long it had been since they had seen each other. Paul passed on Yoko's message that John should come back to New York, but he needed to get his own place at first, court her. Send her flowers, take her out, really make an effort. And of course, John did it. He played by the rules because John loved Yoko. I truly believe that. And it was John's first steps out of the haze we had all found ourselves in.
That's when you quit.
I even went with him to New York, where for the second time in my life, John Lennon had a profound effect on my career. But first, before John accepted Yoko's invitation to head home, there was unfinished business. Unfinished monkey business, that is, to put in Beatles terms.
You can commit murder with that crew.
Because when you look into the future and see nothing but calm domestic bliss, you tend to realize that you have limited time left to break bad.
Thank you.
It was spring of 74, Burbank. Cocaine was going around. All wired as shit in that recording studio. Me, John, Paul, Linda, Jesse Ed Davis on the guitar, the great Bobby Keys on saxophone, May Pang on tambourine, and Stevie Wonder on keys. Paul played Ringo's drums, and Ringo was pissed the next day when he found out. Bobby Keys was probably coming up for air after partying with the Stones. But man, I have no idea how Stevie Wonder, of all people, ended up in there with us. He was probably the only one who stayed straight for the entire session. He passed on grass, man. He just said no to John Lennon.
You want a snort, Steve? A toot. It's going round.
It seemed like the right thing to do, since Paul was in town and he and John were talking and all. Let's all go into the studio and have a laugh.
We laughed like hell all night long.
You would think, with a lineup like that, it would have just killed.
You can commit murder with that crew.
A supergroup. That's what they called those things back in the day. Can you imagine what something like that would have sold if it was released? But the results were really more of a nightmare. Sloppy playing, sloppy singing, mangled, bungled covers. We recorded it on tape while we were in there, but none of us was that idiotic to actually release it. So it circulated as a rumor, and then as a bootleg for years. It's too bad, too, because it's the first and last time that John and Paul played together between when the Beatles broke up and John was shot. A missed opportunity, really. None of us had the mental stability in that moment to recognize that, of course. Well, maybe Stevie Wonder. That studio in Burbank was one of the studios we were using to make Pussycats, my album that John was producing.
Well, rise up. Get yourself Harry Nilsson's new album, Pussycats, produced by John Lennon. Nilsson's latest, Pussycats, on RCA Records and Tapes.
At the time we were making it, we were calling it Strange Pussies. Hey, RCA had let me put Fuck You in the chorus of a song. I figured it was worth a shot.
Meow and purr.
Now, people used to call my voice boyish and angelic. They said I was a delightful mimic and that my voice seemed to spring fully formed from this lanky, dorky body that was simply a vessel for this beautiful gift from God. But when John and I were making Strange Pussies, my voice was anything but angelic. I don't know if it was the bottomless Brandy Alexanders or the cocaine or the cigarettes.
We'll live like Harry.
I don't know if it was the angel dust or horse tranquilizer or whatever the fuck that shit was.
Can you remember one thing? One thing.
I don't think it was the LSD, because I'd never heard of that stuff messing with your throat. My neighbor, Timothy Leary, told me there was absolutely nothing wrong with acid. But my voice was getting worse. Gravelly. Hoarse. Like stretched leather, man. I couldn't hit the upper register. I'd reach for it, and it was like a shelf just out of reach. I tried, over and over again. I tried. John called for another take, and another, and I kept on trying. Kept trying to get there.
And you simply cannot see things for the way they truly are.
Maybe I was trying to impress John, show him that I was really as good as he thought I was. And as soon as I pushed it as far as I could possibly push it, I tasted the blood, there on the back of my throat. I coughed and blood splattered all over the mic. The doctor said my vocal cords had hemorrhaged. He told me to stop talking for 2 weeks, that I had to write everything down.
That's when you stop. Look back. Take stock.
But of course, that was easier said than done. Because when you're driving John Lennon around Los Angeles in a Volkswagen Cura wagon, this military-style Jeep I owned, you basically had to scream to be heard above the rumble of the engine and the howl of the wind.
There's a crazy new thing from Volkswagen that comes with the top up, the top down.
I always had the top down. It was like having a conversation on a fucking runway. People called it the thing, and I chauffeured John any chance I could get. Where to tonight, John?
Was I a bad influence on John Lennon?
Shall we see if there's trouble to be had tonight, John?
Was he a bad influence on me?
Another Brandy Alexander, John? Maybe I did try a little too hard to impress John. It was well past midnight one night when, just out of the blue, John told me he wished he had a couple of girls and a handful of acid. It's like 2-3 in the morning, and you're just now having this burning desire?
You can commit murder with that crew.
I had a hunch that I could deliver. I called up a friend of mine, a girl I figured would be game. She just happened to be awake. And she happened to have a friend with her. And that friend happened to have some acid on her. Like it was meant to be, friend. So I drove John over to her place in the thing. We all dropped acid. And then we all bawled for days. Literally days. I think it was the acid that sustained us. You ever bawled for 2 days straight? On LSD? I don't think I even knew my fucking name after that. My body was as ravaged as my voice. I was barely keeping it together. Strange Pussies was getting stranger.
I think that's when you quit.
At some point, I just looked over at John and told him I needed a break. I asked him when he was leaving for New York, and then I asked if I could go with him.
We'll be right back after this
word.
John Lennon saved my ass. It happened like this. RCA Records didn't want me anymore. I hadn't made a hit in ages. And after that album of standards, which RCA saw as a turkey, the top brass at the label just wanted to cut their losses and move on without me.
I think when you get to self-pity and suicidal thoughts.
My contract was expiring and RCA were not quiet about unceremoniously passing on the renewal option. And then they heard about my voice giving out. You know, the one thing that I had that could potentially make them money. They were gonna bail.
I'm no good. Nobody likes me. Ooh-hoo.
And Pussycats, which is what we were now calling Strange Pussies, well, I don't know, man. That was destined to mold away in some dusty vault like the tapes of that wild recording session with Paul and Stevie Wonder. All I'd wanted to do was make a record with John Lennon.
Was I a bad influence on John Lennon? Was he a bad influence on me?
It was one thing to play on Ringo's records, and Ringo had played on mine. But John was a tougher nut for me to crack. Ringo and I were mates, but there was something unknowable about John. This is gonna sound weird since we spent so much time out on the town together, but it's true. But John was John. He was a walking, talking myth. An icon. And not just a Beatle, but a cultural force. This was never more obvious than when he moved back to New York City upon Yoko's invitation. Now, John and Yoko didn't immediately get back together. People think this last weekend period of his was a few months out in LA. No, the last weekend lasted something like 18 months and spanned his time in LA and New York City. When he got back east, he and May got their own place at Sutton Place, over on East 52nd. Weird that John was courting Yoko but still carrying on with May. None of my business, I suppose. And in New York, John became a legend again among the city's nightclubs. The guy was a social butterfly, man.
You commit murder with that crew.
He was a regular at Ashley's, a disco club at 5th Avenue and 13th Street, where the staff gave him the royal treatment. Drinks on the house, drugs gratis. They let him stay after hours, smoke whatever was left, and snort the rest.
We laughed like hell all night long.
He didn't tell me personally about all the times he visited that brothel on 23rd Street, but I read later that he was a regular. It's crazy to think, someone as famous as John Lennon, in a city as big and as loud as New York, that he could keep those brothel visits hush-hush for so many years. Even now, I'm sure some people don't want to believe that it's true. There's a lot about our heroes that we don't want to know about. But here's one thing about John that's true, and this gets back to my story. John was loyal. He knew that RCA was preparing to dump me, and he put his name and his career on the line to go to bat for me. That was in the spring of 1974. We'd been out all night, and the morning was cruel as usual.
I didn't force any foul-tasting liquids down his throat.
I don't know if I could have gone to sleep if I wanted to. I was telling John about how I'd reached out to RCA to get a new contract signed and how they were continuing to ignore me.
Foul-tasting liquids.
And it just lit this fire under his ass. Let's go over there, John said. Where? I asked him. RCA Records, John responded. Let's go on over to Rockefeller Center and take a meeting with Kenneth Glancy, the git. We'll get him to resign you.
I was the one hanging out with them.
Now, Kenneth Glancy was perhaps the root of my problem. He'd been recently appointed as the new head of RCA, and he didn't like me. The guy before him, Rocco Lagonestra, now he liked me. John didn't give a fuck. It was mid-morning, we'd been up all night, and he had a plan to save my ass. So we went over to Rockefeller Plaza, up to RCA offices, both of us wearing dark sunglasses and hats to conceal whatever the night before had done to us. Though I'm sure the smell of us announced our presence a mile away.
Well, Harry's his big drinker.
John walked right up to the receptionist and said, I'm John Lennon. I'm here with Harry Nilsson, and we need to speak with Kenneth Glancy. The girl practically hyperventilated. The look in her eyes said that she couldn't believe that John Lennon was talking to her. I still didn't know what John was planning, what he could say to this guy besides, I'm John Lennon and you should re-sign Nilsson.
Take your pick.
He could use his fame and legend to get free drinks and drugs at Ashley's. He could make an 18-year-old receptionist blush just by smiling. But these corporate music guys are fucking stoned, man. Obviously, even I was underestimating John at the moment. So we were ushered inside this lavish office overlooking Rockefeller Plaza. Someone shoved cigars and glasses of brandy in our hands.
Well, if they drink, I'll drink.
We sat down in these pristine leather chairs across from the head of RCA. John looked this guy dead in the eyes and says, look, you've got two good artists on this piece of shit label, Elvis Presley and Harry Nilsson. Obviously, at this point, he'd yet to befriend my label mate, David Bowie, but I digress. Glancy raised his finger like he wanted to beg to differ, but John told him he wasn't done yet. And then John pulled the ace out of his back pocket. He told Glancy that if RCA re-signed me for $5 million, then John would sign with RCA too. And he'd do it cheap. Glancy couldn't pick up the phone fast enough. He should have known better. Because who knows what kind of contract John was tied up in at the moment. John didn't really have the knowledge or the ability to be offering himself to any label at that moment. But Glancy bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. Within minutes, the receptionist walked that contract inside the office and we signed on the bottom line for $5 million. Did John ever intend to sign with RCA? Hell no. Though we went through the motions of the whole thing, shaking that dope's hand as we left the office. Yes, yes, very good. I'll have my people call your people. Quite right. Great things. All that. Just smoke. Smoke right up that corporate bastard's ass. That's how John Lennon saved me. And he wasn't bullshitting either. He thought that Elvis and I were the only two notable artists on that label. And then Elvis died, just 2 years later, slumped over on his porcelain throne.
You have no friends except for the ones who are drinking with you.
I remember that day clearly because I immediately thought of John and what he had said to Kenneth Glancy at RCA about me and Elvis and how I owed everything to him.
That's when you stop, look back, take stock.
I owed him my career when I first started, and then I owed him again when it looked like I had fucked everything up beyond repair. And I'm not sure that I was ever in the right state of mind at that time to properly communicate to John just what all that meant to me.
August 1977. As far as John Lennon was concerned, Elvis Presley had died years ago. March 24th, 1958, to be exact. That was the day that Elvis put rock and roll on hold to join the United States Army in Memphis, Tennessee. That's when they killed him, a disillusioned John said. The rest was a living death. There was a time when Elvis had been John's religion. John was nearly struck dumb when he first heard Heartbreak Hotel as a teenager. Elvis was everything. Elvis was it. Elvis Presley showed John Lennon what he would be. But later, after the Beatles had broken up and after he'd returned from the service, Elvis turned his back on John when he said what he really thought about the Liverpudlian lads who had once idolized him. He told these things directly to President Richard Nixon. He sold out John as an anti-American rabble-rouser. He said John abused drugs. He said John planted conspiratorial ideas in the minds of America's impressionable youth. Of course, the irony of that conversation is that the king of rock and roll could have been describing himself. If Nixon didn't know it at the time, he likely figured it out on August 16, 1977, when Elvis Aaron Presley was found dead on his toilet, his bloated body loaded on drugs and his legacy one of filling the impressionable young minds of American youth with hip-twisting, naughty thoughts. In Elvis's obituary for the Village Voice, rock critic and perennial curmudgeon Lester Bangs wrote that, "We will never again agree on anything as we agreed on Elvis." That's a quote. Lester Bangs was right, just like John was right, that Elvis was never the same after he returned from serving in the Army. And in the late 1970s, rock and roll wasn't itself anymore. Rock was no longer king. Rock now had to share room on the radio dial with disco, punk, prog, and funk. And fans became zealots who defended their chosen genre to the death. RCA Records, on the other hand, went all in on Elvis. In the wake of Elvis's death, the entire world clamored for Elvis Presley records. This was a time long before streaming music, long before instant music, a time where you had to have a physical copy of a 12-inch slab of wax of the title you longed to hear. Retail stores sold out of Elvis's entire catalog. RCA's pressing plants operated 24 hours a day to meet the demand, and even subcontracted other plants to help. One-third of all albums sold in America between the fall of 1977 and the fall of 1978 were Elvis Presley albums. And so, with RCA laser-focused on around-the-clock operation to keep Elvis Presley's memory alive, they forgot about the other guy. The guy who, according to John Lennon, was the only other artist of consequence on that label. Harry Nilsson wasn't long for the RCA stables anyway. His final RCA album, Knilsson, that's his surname but spelled with a whole bunch of N's and a K at the beginning that shouldn't be there, was released in the summer of 1977, right before Elvis's heart gave out. As a result, RCA shifted all the money and resources they had planned to use to promote Harry's record over to repressing and replenishing Elvis's catalog from coast to coast. The timing was absolute shit, but Harry had a laugh that it was absurdly poetic. Nilsson was intended to be Harry's triumphant return. He was focused again, his vocal cords had healed, and his voice, while not the sublime instrument it once was on the mend. But triumph was not in the cards for Harry Nilsson. He received no support from his label, and there was no going away party when his contract came to an unceremonious end. Harry hadn't seen his old friend and ass-saver, John Lennon, in years when, in 1980, he landed an opportunity to write songs for a new movie by American auteur-director Robert Altman. Popeye was a truly bizarre yet undeniably endearing adaptation of the popular comic strip starring Robin Williams as the spinach-chomping sailor and Shelley Duvall as Olive Oil. Harry injected more than a little of that Lost Weekend spirit into the tipsy melodies of the soundtrack, which sounded even odder in the actual film because the cast members sang the songs live instead of in post-production, as was usually the case. Harry's Popeye soundtrack was a stark contrast to John and Yoko's latest album, which was released a month earlier. Double Fantasy presented some of John's most lucid, domestic music of his entire career. Harry and John were still fellow pussycats, it's just that one of them still preferred an occasional stroll down a back alley while the other was content curling up in front of a fireplace. John was playing the part of the housebound pussycat at the Dakota in New York City on Saturday, December 6, 1980, when Popeye made its much-anticipated premiere in Los Angeles. John never did get a chance to see the film or hear Harry's delightfully skewed soundtrack, because 2 days later, on December 8, 1980,
The unthinkable happened and the entire world changed in a blink. The news would travel fast and hit Harry hard. He wouldn't be able to think about anything else for years. Not music, not pussycatting. He would turn from cat to bulldog and take on the NRA to lobby for sweeping gun control reform. But before that, Harry spent the weekend of December 6th in a darkened movie theater in LA, watching Robin Williams and Shelley Duvall sing his songs on the big screen. He became caught up in Van Dyke Park's evocative orchestrations and was swept away to a place that was part fantasy and part reality. The kind of place that only music or a movie can take you. The kind of place where you could dance till 2:45. The kind of place where the good times would never end and no one got old, no one grew cold. There was no pain or struggle or conflict or strife. And there certainly was no blood on the tracks. All right, everybody, thanks for listening to Blood on the Tracks. If you like what you hear, be sure to find and follow Blood on the Tracks on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. On this season 2 of Blood on the Tracks, we'll be releasing 10 episodes on the incredible life of John Lennon, with a new episode every Thursday. You can also binge all 10 episodes of season 1 on the insane story of the notorious record producer Phil Spector. Right now, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Blood on the Tracks was written by Zeth Lundy and hosted and executive produced by me, Jake Brennan. Also executive produced by Brady Sadler. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy. This episode was mixed by Colin Fleming. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. This episode featured Chris Anzalone as Harry Nilsson. Blood on the Tracks is produced by Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. If you want to chat about this show or hear more about the other shows we're making at Double Elvis, tap in on Instagram at Double Elvis, on Twitter at Double Elvis FM, and now on Twitch, where we're streaming 3 days a week at twitch.tv/Double Elvis Podcasts. And finally, be sure to check out Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. To hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, go to amazon.com/Disgraceland, or if you have an Echo device, just say, Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast. Rock and roll.
Bye, crazy. Oh, dang it.